I'm very happy to introduce today's guest, not only because she is Canadian, but she also happens to be one of the original rock and roll maidens from the early 80s. And she's very, very talented. She is a multi-platinum recording artist, having put out fantastic albums like Metal Queen, Call of the Wild, and Body Rock. Since the 80s, she has diversified herself into a very well-rounded singer and musician. She now has a brand new album out titled Fire and Gasoline on her own label, Big Sister Records. So without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Lee Aaron. Hi, Lee.
Hey, how you doing, Tony?
Good, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing awesome, although I'm out in Ontario right now and there's freezing rain everywhere, so it was kind of a bit of a switch to come out here. But yeah, I'm doing good otherwise.
Really? Wow. So you left the calm and cloudiness and raininess of White Rock to that?
Well, no, I left the calm and cloudiness of White Rock to go to Puerto Vallarta last week, which was amazing.
Oh.
And then I flew back home for one day, and then I flew to Ontario because I'm crazy. So, no, I'm actually, it's Easter, so I'm out here to visit family. And yeah, so it's good. It's good. Except for the freezing rain.
Are you originally from Toronto?
I am. Well, the Toronto area.
Yeah.
I grew up, spent my high school years in Brampton, Ontario, which is, it's all part of Toronto now. It's like the Northwest End. And yeah, so I spent quite a few years out there and graduated from a high school out in that area and then moved back into the Toronto area. In fact, I was, this year, I've been inducted into the Brampton Arts, onto the Brampton Arts Walk of Fame. So I actually get a star on the sidewalk in Northwestern Toronto, believe it or not.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, I didn't even know. When they asked me, would I accept the nomination to be inducted, I went, sure, I guess so. I had no idea that it was actually like the Hollywood Walk of Fame in northwestern Toronto, though. And then I got the email, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm actually getting a star on the sidewalk. That's bizarre. So, yeah, it's kind of cool.
That is very cool. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, who would have ever thunk? You know, I don't know what's cooler, you know, Hollywood or Brampton. Brampton's a big place, though, these days, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, Hollywood is internationally recognized as, you know, the place for the whole stars and such. But, you know, in here in Canada, it's Brampton.
It is. So. But there's some cool alumni from there. There's, you know, Scott Thompson from Kids in the Hall. I think they were telling me Johnny Reed is from there as well. Like, so yeah, there's some pretty famous people that actually came from that area. So it's very interesting.
So you have a brand new album out called Fire and Gasoline. It's a really good record. It's very upbeat. It's got a lot of attitude. You know, I love tracks like Tomboy and Bittersweet, and you know, the title track is cool. They all have their own sort of individual characteristic, I guess, their own persona.
Oh yeah. Okay. Sure. Is that a question or?
No. I'm just making a statement.
Okay. Well, you know, it's interesting because some people have, you know, I've talked to a few people that like love the album because the songs, and that is what I was actually aiming for each of the songs to sort of have their own personality, their own entity. Because to me, you know, when I was a kid and I listened to, my favorite records were, you know, things like Fleetwood Mac Rumors, where, you know, you can go from, you know, Christy McVie singing a tender piano ballad to Secondhand News, which is almost like bluegrass rock, to stuff, something like The Chain with Stevie Nicks singing, which is like sort of like, how to explain it, heavy blues rock. And then, you know, Dreams, which is like a pop song, right? And I loved albums like that because they keep you engaged. They're not boring, and they take you sort of on a musical journey. And the continuity is the fact that it's the same writers, you know, the same songwriters and the same musicians actually playing on all the songs. And so that was my goal with this album, was to make an album like that that takes you on a musical journey and gives you stuff to think about and keeps you engaged.
Well, I think you've achieved that. I really do. And, you know, I'm glad you agree with me because, yeah, each song has its own identity. And that's really cool because, you know, there's a lot of diversity on this album. So let's talk about the song Tomboy. The video is really cool. You have your daughter in there on guitar, and I'm assuming all her friends?
That's right. Well, when we went to, we had bounced, and me and the distributor had bounced around ideas for a first single, and they just sort of felt that Tomboy had all those elements, that it had enough of, you know, a catchy, hooky chorus, some pop overtones to it, but that it had this edgy, nasty side to it that was, you know, perfectly Lee Aaron. And so we ended up picking that track. And the problem I have is that half my band is from Toronto. So there was a bit of an expensive logistical issue with getting everybody in the same city to film a video, because there's obviously expense involved with that as well. And I was, you know, mulling over, you know, what am I going to do? How am I going to do this? I'd spoken with the director, and then I was just out for a walk on the beach one day with my husband, and it dawned on me. I went, man, actually, it might be cool to actually have the band be Tomboys, you know? And because the song was inspired by my 10-year-old, well, she's 11 now, but she was 10 at the time, my daughter. And, you know, the song's all about that free-spirited, unself-conscious energy that young girls have before they hit their teenage years, and they're comfortable in their own skin, and they have attitude, and they kind of are very sure of themselves and sure about the world and confident around boys, you know, before they hit that stage where they're, you know, sexualized by, you know, the images that were bombarded with modern media, right? And they become self-conscious. And I love that. I love that energy. And that was what that song was, you know, is all about, capturing that. And so it just sort of seemed to make, was a completely logical, natural choice to have her and her friends. I recruited them for the video, and they were totally up for it. And I was really impressed with how those girls, you know, we spent an afternoon just sort of showing them how to, like, fake, you know, air guitar and fake their instruments. And they were just, yeah, they just totally rose to the occasion. It was really, really a super fun day when we shot that video.
Yeah, you know, and I got that just by watching the video. And, you know, I honestly thought some of them maybe play instruments.
Well, you know what? The girl that impressed me the most was Angela's friend, Tiana. We got her on the drum. She had never sat behind a drum kit. But she's got great timing. And I said, just, you know, we started with, let's just tap your sticks in time, and then just try hitting the snare drum on time. Just try to, you know, hitting the kick drum in time. And she totally got it. Like, within a half an hour, she was, like, literally playing the drums. It was unbelievable.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's a great age, right? They're sort of very, like, sponges and very receptive at that age to pick things up. So, yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, my father told me that at age 3, I was making beats. I don't remember back then, but I've been playing drums since then. Long time. Yeah.
That's awesome.
I love the drums. I tried playing an electronic kit. I actually bought a Roland, I think it was a TD-12 or something. It cost me $5,000.
No.
Yeah.
No. Okay. Sorry, I won't continue.
Is there a story behind that?
Well, my husband is a drummer, and he plays on the album, and he's also, I guess you'd, for lack of a better word, say a drum aficionado. Like, he has kits from the 1920s right up to, like, I think probably his oldest kit is maybe something that he bought in the early 80s, but he has kits, he's a collector, so we have about 20 drum kits at our house, and he's got kits from the 60s, and, you know, he just hates electronic drums.
Okay, so having said that, I will tell you that I feel the same way. It was my first kick at the can, so to speak. And honestly, just doesn't have the same feel, not even close to an acoustic kit. I took lessons for 10 years, starting at age 7, by a guy named Jay Dallimore, and he's from White Rock, and I want to give a shout out to him real quickly. He's in Kelowna now. Yeah, so I agree with your husband 100%.
Well, that's the thing, eh? People buy them because of the sound issue, right? With but there's nothing that can replace. It's sort of, I feel the same way about reading a Kobo or actually holding a real book in my hand. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
It's the same with, like, you just, there's something that just doesn't replace turning real pages. I find those Kobo things give you eye fatigue as well. And I mean, so, yeah, there's nothing that can replace hitting a real drum skin, right?
No, I agree. It's funny you mentioned the Kobo thing because I just had this conversation with my best friend last night. We were talking about it and I just, you know, I like a real book.
Yeah, totally. I hear you.
But back to your album here. So you guys recorded this at Little Mountain Sound in Vancouver.
Well, Little Mountain Sound divided into two studios a little while back. I mean, in the advent of digital age, there are project studios that have cropped up everywhere. And unfortunately, it's caused the business in the bigger studios to really wane because people don't have to go into big studios and pay that money to do projects anymore because they can, you don't even have to live in the same city as your band to make a record in these days, you know, because you can just send files back and forth. But so Little Mountain became the farm and the factory, the studio, Studio A and Studio B turned into two studios. But I had a sort of a longstanding association with Garth Richardson from years ago. In fact, Garth, believe it or not, who's become a big studio owner and a very reputable producer in his own right. Believe it or not, he was like the coffee boy on Metal Queen, you know. And I mean that with the highest amount of respect. He was like the assistant studio engineer on my first like record, because he was a young guy and he had gotten into the studio business through his father, right, back there. So him and I have a long-standing kind of like, friendship / association that goes back for years and years. So when I found out that he had the farm was owned by him, I said that'd be great. I'd love to go in there. And just the history in that studio, the amazing records that have been done there, you know, over the years, there really is like an energy when you walk into that room and you see those records on the wall and the haphazard sort of, you know, trophies and liquor bottles and weird things that are in there from many years of many legacies of many records gone by. There was just a really cool energy. And plus, it's a fabulous sounding room and a fabulous console. And I was able to get Ben Kaplan, who had, you know, engineered, you know, bands like Mother and Headley and like just a world-class engineer as well. And I said to the guys in my band, you know, because it's funny because Sean Kelly from Nelly Furtado has become my guitar player, and we wrote some stuff together, and we wrote 5 tracks on the album together. And, you know, he's like, well, you know, you can always shoot the tracks out and I can record them at Coalition Sound in Toronto. I'm like, no. You're flying out here. We're doing pre-production and we're all going to be in the same room and we're all going to play together and make a record. The fact that that's actually called old school to me these days is beyond me. It's like, that's the way records should be made. Musicians actually looking at each other, heads up, you know, like in the same room playing their instruments together. Isn't that the way records are supposed to be made?
Yep, I agree.
And so that I was just like, no, we're not doing a record any other way. And so, but for some people in the industry now, it was sort of like, that was like, wow, really? You're going to fly your band out and actually, like, you know, spend multiple days recording in the same studio? It's like, that was sort of, it seemed like a bizarre concept to everybody. And I was like, yeah. So, yeah, that's how we did it. And, we cut all the bed tracks and guitar overdubs in 4 days in there.
And then that's impressive.
And then after that, what I did is I took it out and I completed my vocal tracks in a smaller studio in Burnaby with John Webster, who, by the way, has played on all those huge albums in the 80s and 90s. He's also an amazing engineer. And so he's built himself a little world-class studio out in Burnaby. And I completed all my vocal tracks out there, and we mixed the record together, and voilà. Then you have Fire and Gasoline.
And Fire and Gasoline is a great record. First of all, how did you come up with that title? What inspired that?
Well, actually, it wasn't me, to be honest with you. We just wrote a bunch of, you know, there's all the tracks on the album, and we were really, really struggling an album title. And one of the guys at Caroline said to me, he said, why don't you just call it Fire and Gasoline? He said, it's my favorite track on the record. And, you know, he said he just felt it was indicative of the spirit of the album, like Fire and Gasoline is a combustible substance. And he said, you know, the album to me really just sounds like an explosive comeback. And he said, I think it's very indicative of the energy of the record. And also the lyric content. You know, I write a lot about things that are, you know, volatile, like human relationships, and which fascinate me, you know, and what makes people tick. And so when he suggested that, I thought, great. And the other reasoning behind that as well is we were trying to find an album, an English album title that would translate into other languages, like, say, German. And when you read Fire and Gasoline, you know it's a rock record. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, it does.
Yeah, without having to spell it out. And it's very, you know, translatable into multiple languages, because the album at this point has, we have distribution in Europe, the UK, Japan, the United States, Canada, Brazil, and Argentina. So that was sort of the reasoning behind it as well. And it's a track off the album, so it seemed to make a lot of sense.
Well, I think it's a very appropriate title. And you mentioned that someone told you an appropriate comeback. You know, it is, for lack of a better term, sort of a comeback for you, because it just has that feel, you know, like, let's take the Body Rock album as an example. I mean, I remember when that came out, that was like 89, right? I think it was in 1989.
Yeah.
And you had a lot of hits from that album. You had like five or six singles, didn't you?
Well, three that we did videos for, but yeah, there was... we didn't really call them singles, but they were more like AOR focus tracks.
Yeah,
you know,
What
You Do to My Body was like a video hit. So was Hands On. Sweet Talk came next. But then there were quite a few other, they went deeper into tracks on the album, like for AOR radio, like Nasty Boys, Yesterday. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to think, Rock the Hard Way, Rebel Angel. Yeah, like, so a lot of those tracks got spun on AOR radio. For sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I mean to say is that this album, it just kind of has that same feel. You know what I mean?
No, you know what? I really hope that that is what happens, because generally the reviews so far have been very positive. And even some of the, like, how do I explain it? What I was saying to you before we started the interview was that some of the more diehard metal zines that are out there that have criticized the album for maybe being a little bit too pop catchy, you know what I mean? It's come under a little bit of fire for not being quote-unquote metal enough, diehard metal enough, and but they've all said that even though it's not personally their you know, hardcore metal taste, that they're all good songs, that the songs are really catchy. And so, and you know, that's all I was trying to do, is making it, like, you know, first and foremost, you know, no matter what genre of music, I do consider myself a songwriter. And to me, you know, a good song is a good song is a good song. And my goal was to write great songs for this record. And, you know, if we've accomplished that, then I'm happy.
And you've done that. You have.
Thank you.
Well, it's true. Yeah, there probably are those people out there who are expecting Metal Queen 2, but that was 30 years ago, over 30 years ago now. And though it's part of your past and it's part of your, you know, legacy as an artist, it's 2016 now. You don't have to necessarily do Metal Queen 2.
I think it would be embarrassing if I did. You know what I mean?
How so?
It's not, well, it's funny because I joke around with my husband and I always say to him, you know, the day that I look like a cartoon jumping around with a guitar, please let me know, because that'll be the day I should quit, you know? So, you know, It's interesting because it seems like there's other genres like jazz and even country where a woman can mature and not be embarrassing. But rock is a super hard genre to do that in, you know, because there's this sort of overriding, how do I explain it? The way it is that it's marketed, like especially in the 80s and 90s, like especially women, we were marketed in a very sexualized way. So to be able to grow comfortably in your own skin and to mature without coming under criticism that, I mean, I was reading some reviews of the Lita Ford Femme Fatale tour that had just gone across the country, and a lot of the Facebook feedback was, man, they look old. And it's like, well, they are older. And it's almost unfair. How do I explain it? I'm probably not articulating it very well, but it's...
I understand. I get you.
But you know who I think is doing it extremely well? And they're a generation ahead of me. I was a fan with Heart. Like, I was really
Absolutely.
Influenced by Heart. But those gals, man, they still look fantastic and they still look classy. And, you know, my goal is to mature in... I take my cues from those gals, from the Wilson sisters, because I think they've done it in a very sophisticated and respectable way. And that's my goal, is I want to mature in a way, artistically, the way they have. And, I don't know if I'm really saying it in the right way, but... and so I would like to think that Fire and Gasoline, while it still has all of the elements of Edge that you would expect from a former Lee Aaron record, you know, obviously I have different things to talk about because I'm not 20 anymore, right? You know, I'm a woman who's grown up and I've got a young family, and my whole worldview is different than it was 20 years ago or 25 years ago. And I would like to think that my fans have grown up with me, obviously, and they're interested in the things that they care about the same things I care about now as well.
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, we all mature, right?
Well, no, we don't all mature, but...
And no, you're not 20 anymore, but you still look 20. You must not smoke, you must not drink, you must not do drugs, you must not, drink a lot of pop or whatever, I don't know. But you're doing something right.
Well, I think my kids keep me young. And just living healthy, I think, is really important. Taking care of yourself and living healthy is important, right? For everybody.
Yeah, it is important. And I'm sure that the Wilson sisters do the same thing. Bad Animals was actually my very first concert ever.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was 15. I remember that. It was at the Pacific Coliseum here in Vancouver. And it was fantastic. When you look at previous Lee Aaron records, one song that I really love still is Human. And when you talk about maturity, I think that was a very mature song back then too. You mentioned earlier that some of these songs on this new album focus on human relationships and the complexity of them. I'm assuming If You Don't Love Me Anymore is one of them.
Well, actually, yeah, If You Don't Love Me Anymore was the first song that I wrote with Sean Kelly for the album.
Mm-hmm.
And there's different methodologies that I go about writing. I mean, to me, the best songs write themselves. And usually if I'm writing solo, which the six songs on the album are written just by myself, quite often the idea it formulates in my head and I can't even get it out quick enough, you know? But when I'm writing with another writer, like, say, Sean, he had sent me that track demo. Like, he demoed just the music portion of it. And it was almost fully formed. And I, because he'd played me the iPhone idea on his iPhone. We were on a little mini tour. And I said, yeah, demo that up and send it to me. But it's a little more difficult for me because I have to hear the song over and over again. And then whatever phrase or whatever vibe sort of comes into my head in terms of writing a top line and melody and words. And so I'd listened to that over and over again, and this If You Don't Love Me Anymore kept popping into my head over that top line. But I was like, you know, I just can't write a breakup song, you know, a victim-y kind of, you know, If You Don't Love Me Anymore. And then
we'll leave that to Adele.
Yeah, well, and those songs are great too. But yeah, and then it occurred to me, well, what about a more mature twist on that, about how we feel, you know, when you've been in a long-term relationship and you're struggling and you don't feel like you love someone anymore, but you know that feeling is going to pass, because true love really is about sticking it out, right, through thick and thin, even when you don't feel those affections for a person, right? That is a far more mature love. And so that's what that song is about, really.
I get that. But, you know, in terms of the album overall as a whole,
mm-hmm.
you had mentioned that you can't please everybody. You just wanted to be happy with yourself. And I think in the end, that's what's most important. I know that you have to cater to your fans, but you wanted to be happy with yourself. You wanted to be happy with the end product.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, in the 80s, when I was under contract to a label, you know, there were, even though I had successful records, there were definitely times where I felt like I was being really pushed or pulled in a certain direction by the label to, and a perfect example is the Some Girls Do album. I mean, I'm very happy with that record, and it went platinum in Canada. It was a very successful record, but there was a lot of pressure on us, I feel, at that time to repeat the success of Body Rock. So there were a lot of songs for that album that didn't see the light of day, that to me were an evolution beyond Body Rock. And I think that might have, you know, in terms of building a career as an artist that's based on, you know, more longevity, might have been better choices for that record. But they really wanted us to make like almost a carbon copy of Body Rock, because and I understand, you know, when you're the business suit behind something and you're the person investing all the money, you want a repeat of your success. But I don't know, in the 80s, the music industry just evolved into that, where it became more about dollars and cents, and not, like, at least in the 60s, it was sort of more about artist development. Even though I was, like, a little tiny girl in the 60s, you know, my understanding of music history is that it was far more like that. And, you know, I'm hoping that we get to a place where it becomes like that again, you know?
Yeah, it would be nice. You know, music has evolved so much. You said earlier, you don't even have to be in the same room these days. You can have, like, five different musicians in five different cities.
And you don't even have to know how to play your instrument. You just need to know how to play three chords and program a loop, you know?
Yep.
Or, you know, you don't even have to sing. You can just use pitch correction. I mean, it's unbelievable, the tools that we have at our disposal that prevent people from really honing their craft and becoming really good at their craft. You know, I don't know if you've read any Malcolm Gladwell, but, you know, there's definitely something to be said for putting in the 10,000 hours to be good at your craft. And I mean, people that have, you know, come out of the music industry in the era that I did, they've put in their 10,000 hours. But I worry about, you know, younger artists today, because they don't have to. And quite often you have successful records, but then you go see these bands live and they're terrible because they've got no stage presence. They can't actually play.
No, I'm with you there, Lee. I agree 100%. Are you watching American Idol at all, the last season?
No, I don't watch. I don't watch those shows. And it's funny, because someone asked me about that just recently, and they said, you know, do you watch those shows? Would you ever be on a show like that? And it's like, you know, besides Kelly Clarkson, you know, name me one artist that has a career out of those shows.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Name me one. You know, like, come on. They are purely entertainment. And it's heartbreaking entertainment, because they, you know, people get their dreams shot down. I'm not into it, I have to be honest. But I think that there's, you know, I think that there's a real hunger out there for the younger generation wanting to hear real music. There's a, like, I notice even at my shows, there's a resurgence of, you know, kids that are finding out about, you know, their parents' music. So I have, like, some, I'm doing shows and there's like 20-year-olds in the front row, and I'm like, hey, aren't you supposed to be at home being babysat right now? I'm just kidding. But, you know, like, I have sometimes these fans, and they're just, like, crazy Leanne fans. And I'm like, you're, like, 20. And they're like, yeah, but my dad, who's 45, has your records. And I love you. And it's bizarre. So I think that there's a whole generation out there just hungering for real music. You know, and I think, you know, the success of bands like Monster Truck and Rival Sons and even a singer like Adele, well, of course you're going to love her because her voice cracks and it breaks and it's powerful and it sounds like a real person singing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, there's a reason she sold multi-million albums, because I think people want something that sounds authentic out there, you know. And I know that when I cut my vocals with John Webster, you know, he was like, okay, how do you want to do this? And I'm like, I'll tell you how I'm going to do this, is you're going to play it, I'm going to sing it four times through, and then you can put together a comp. You know, like, I'll sing a song from front to finish four times, and you can just go in there and find the lines you think I sang the best and put it together, rather than punching in line out. You know, I'm not into that. You know, it needs to sound like an entire performance in its entirety to me.
Well, I mean, that's the best way to do it, because then it sounds, like you said, authentic. And I think that's what's the most important aspect of creating music these days.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the music that we like. And don't get me wrong. I mean, my kids listen to Katy Perry and Maroon 5 and some of the pop, you know, the pop stuff, Bruno Mars, you know. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, I like some of it. It's catchy. But I guess my question is, you know, we're still listening to Led Zeppelin and Stevie Wonder and Bob Dylan. And, you know, are kids going to still be listening to Maroon 5 in 30 years?
Probably not.
I mean, that's what I wonder about. Like, is this music today going to have, you know, longevity? You know, are these Beatles songs? I don't know. I question that. Seems like the craft of songwriting has really changed, right? So anyway, you know what? I sound like a grumpy old lady. I sound like a cranky old grandma or something talking to you.
No, you don't.
You know?
No, you don't. You're speaking your mind. And I get you, because I'm pretty much from the same generation as you are.
Yeah.
There was a recent interview in Rolling Stone with Gene Simmons, and he said that he is looking forward to the death of rap. So let's just take this as an example. You know, obviously he's very vocal about the fact that he does not like rap music. Okay, that's fine. We're all entitled to our opinion. But he got a lot of backlash from some rappers, I can't remember their names, about that. But, you know, that sort of ties into what you're saying, because here's a guy who obviously is in a rock and roll band, and it's amazing to me that, you know, after 40 years, Kiss are still kicking it. They're, you know, getting up there in age too. We all get older, but what's the music landscape going to look like in the next 20 or 30 years? Are they going to be able to access real music, or is it all going to be computerized where you just press a button and, okay, let's output some music?
Well, you know, the other thing, just to chime in on that, is the way that young people access music is so different now. They, you know, I don't know about you, but I still like actually having a CD to have and to hold and to take out the lyrics sleeve. And when I put it out there on my site, what do you want, like, from my fans? They're like, please give us a CD that has a booklet and lyrics and lots of pictures and lots of things to have and to hold and to look at. And I thought, okay. In a jewel case, you know, not a paper case that's going to get water damaged. And I was like, okay, that's what you want. So that's what I did with this album. I wanted to give my fans exactly what they wanted. But, you know, the way, young people access, you know, it's just, it's like, you know, the Apple Music channel, or it's Spotify, it's streaming, right? But, I mean, I can tell you, as, you know, an artist who's been co-opted out to a bunch of those sources for play, not of my own volition, because my publishing and for all of my older Attic albums was bought out by a company called Unidisc, and so they've and Pure Music, and so they've put it out there. I just got a statement 2 days ago, and I was going through the statement. I actually counted, you know, it's like, okay, so for 2,700 streams, do you know what my check was?
Can I take a guess?
Sure.
$20.
59, but close. And I went, okay, I've got 2,700. 2,700 plays, and I got $59.
Oh, wow, that's a real big payday as a recording artist.
But you know what? For that many plays on a radio station, I probably would have got about $1,200 in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I'm sorry to hear that.
But this is the way it's changing, is what I'm saying. And I've actually heard of that as well. Artists that have had like over a million streams on one of those channels and got a check for $600. The problem is, people creating original music can't afford to continue to do it. Do you understand? Because
the
young generation thinks they should be able to receive art for free.
Yep, it's entitlement. They feel entitled to be able to go online and say, okay, guess what? I don't have to pay for this, so I won't. I'll just listen to it, or I'll just, you know, steal it, which I'm completely against.
But these aren't even stealing. This is just the new delivery of the way music.
Okay, so you're just talking about, like, streaming?
Yeah, like the way the music is delivered to people, but the royalties have dropped for artists on the recipients of the people creating the art. Our paychecks have gone from like down to like 3% of what they used to be.
That's what I'm sort of saying.
So it's putting artists in a position where they can't afford to keep creating the art, is my point. And so it's just, there's not a lot of motivating factors there. I mean, we all still have our, you know, we have bills to pay too and families to support. And so it's just, I'm curious to know how that is going to impact the future of music as well and the artists that are making it. Like, I'm not going to go on a rant about liking one genre of music or another, like Gene Simmons. Like, you know what? I think there's actually great rap out there. Just like every other genre of music, there's good and there's crap, right?
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, there's artists out there making extremely amazing, valid rap music. So I'm not about to go on a rant about a particular genre, but for me, it's about the delivery of how music is being delivered to the customer, how and what that royalty rate looks now like for artists now. Like, because I was, it was the first time through an organization called MROC, Musicians' Rights Organizations Canada, that pays you these royalties that I'd gotten. And like the statement that came in the mail was like, it was a booklet with all of the, and some songs I made one penny when they were streamed, some of them I made zero. And I go, how can they actually do that? It gets a stream, but it doesn't make, I don't know. I have to go look at that royalty statement again. It's very, very interesting. But anyway, yada, yada. Well,
it's almost insulting. A penny, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
That's
like a slap in the face.
But that's the way that streaming works.
Looking at the technology these days and how people want their music distributed to them, what's the solution?
I don't really know, because it used to be that if you, you know, wanted to have a song, you had to pay even a download fee to get it, or you had to go buy the album. But with streaming, these companies access the rights to all of this material, and then they just charge you like a monthly $10 fee to get unlimited music. So you got to understand how that changes the royalty rate for all the artists.
Absolutely, it does. Yeah.
You understand what I mean? So I don't really know. I'm kind of, I'm interested to see how it will affect the future of music and who's able to afford to continue to make it.
What I'm curious about is how can these companies say, okay, we'll charge you $10 a month flat rate. You can listen to unlimited albums. Where do they find the means to do that? Because shouldn't they be having to pay a license fee?
Well, it's a bit of an erroneous thing that I don't fully even understand right now. Yeah, obviously they have to pay some type of licensing fee, I'm assuming from the publishers that have the rights to the albums, to the material, the songs, right? So what it is, it's just the infrastructure of the whole music industry and how music is delivered to the customer is changing. You understand what I'm saying, right?
Absolutely, so, I do, yeah.
Yeah, like I don't really know what to say other than that. It's interesting to see. And, that was my first experience at actually receiving a streaming royalty statement. I'd never gotten one before. And, and I was just kind of like, wow, look at this. It was the biggest royalty document that had ever come in the mail. And I went, and the smallest check. So there you go.
Wow. Not a lot you can do with $59 these days.
No, maybe buy a dinner out at A&W for my family. <Just kidding. laughs> So anyway, I'm just trying to keep my sense here. Anyway, we're off on a rant here. We should talk about the new record, and then I'm going to have to wrap it up here and get my on with my day here, Mr. Tony.
It's a real interesting topic of discussion because I think it should and needs to be addressed. By the powers that be in the music industry. But, I'm really happy to hear that your fans wanted an actual CD. And I'm holding the copy that you sent me in my hands right now. And thank you again for that. I appreciate it. I'm the same way. I like having an actual CD. I don't like digital downloads. I don't like streaming. I'm old-fashioned. I like to have a CD in my hands where I can read the liner notes, how it was produced, or whatever, who it was produced by, whatever. I can read lyrics. I can look at photos. And I have an actual disc.
Yeah.
I'm glad that there are fans out there of yours that wanted this. That's really good, not only because it helps you, but it helps them too, and it helps the preservation of how music should be distributed, in my opinion, anyway.
Well, and there's going to be people that are always still going to want a physical piece of product, right?
Yeah.
And the artists that have become the most successful, even in the last few years, like Adele, I keep going back to that as an example, actually sold, they moved physical copies of that CD because people wanted that. And, Adele's audience is not necessarily the 19-year-olds. It's the, the 25 to 60-year-old crowd. Like she's got really wide demographic appeal, as well. So, and, a lot of those people, they want an actual disc, right? So
when you look at all of the songs on here, what is your absolute favorite?
On my new album?
Yes.
I hate getting asked that question. How can I?
Let's rephrase it. What are your favorite songs? We'll pluralize it.
Oh, boy. Well, I like different songs for different reasons. I love Tomboy because it captures sort of it's a snapshot of my adoration and love for my daughter in a song, I love the song Find the Love, which is the last song on the album. Because it was inspired by, finding out a friend of mine was very ill. We lost her last June, which is very sad, but, the song, you sort of evolved and it became a song about it, for anyone who's ever lost someone or had their life touched by loss. I was hoping that it would become an inspirational song for them as well. And so that song's very near and dear to my heart. I love Fire and Gasoline because it's got, I feel Fire and Gasoline has the best of the elements of everything I've done throughout my music career, which is it's got a lot of rock edge. It's got a bluesy funk underbeat. It's got, sort of a rock/blues vocal. you know, and it was just some real fun lyric writing for me. I'm just trying to think. I just talked to someone earlier today, said their favorite song was 50 Miles from Memphis. And I like that song as well. That, I don't know if you're familiar with my album from 2004, Beautiful Things, but there was a song on that album called Handcuffed to a Fence in Mississippi. Again, with, it had a very sort of dark Southern blues rock vibe to it. And so 50 Miles from Memphis was meant to be like a companion song for that tune, continuation of that story. So, yeah. So those are a few.
So are you planning on doing any touring for this album in the near future? I think you have some Canadian festivals coming up in the summer, right?
I do. So at this point, as you, like, it's obviously extraordinarily expensive to take a band to Europe, but the album is coming out over there and it's getting some momentum already. So I think that the touring is going to be a response to the performance of the album. Like, I know that we're sort of bouncing around some ideas of coming over to do some selected European festival dates to help promote the record. Am I going to go out and tour like I'm 20, doing little clubs all across the country? No. I just, you know, I don't know that anyone can even afford to do that anymore. The touring scene has changed so much. But will you see me in almost every major city in within the next year to support Fire and Gasoline? Yes, you probably will. That will be on the agenda. But it's not going to be like I'm going to get in a van and it's going to be a 6-week back-to-back tour. It's going to be more like isolated pockets of dates to support the record in different markets, yes. But, yeah, I mean, I've never really stopped playing live, even during my 11-year recording hiatus. obviously, I had my children 10 and 11 years ago, so I did take a hiatus from recording, but I've always gone out and done selected dates throughout the year. And with Fire and Gasoline getting some momentum, I will be looking at definitely doing some more touring dates this year to support the record, for sure. So will you see me? You know, I was in Vancouver in August at the PNE. last year.
Were you? So
I was, and I was going to say.
I didn't know that.
Because I don't often play my own hometown, but yeah. Keep your eyes open, because I will be around.
I will. Sure. That would be good to see you live. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Gosh, if I'd have known that, I would have gone to the PNE. I normally don't go to the PNE because it's so busy, but.
It was a great show. It was really fun.
Are you still going to play your classics?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I have to play your classics.
People ask me what songs will always be in your set list. I'm like, Metal Queen, But What You Do to My Body, for sure. Some Girls Do. They'll always be there, you know. And they're great songs. And they, you know, when I look out in my audience and I see, like, you know, for a lot of people, when I launch into one or more of those songs, and I see the look on their face and just the joy that it incites in their heart, because it's, you know, it's taken them back to a place that, you know, it's a favorite memory or a time in their life that was just different than now. It's just a really neat feeling to see how much joy you bring people by, you know, going back and playing those songs.
When you look at the next, let's say, 5 years, do you see another Lieran album coming out in that time period?
I do.
That's good.
It's funny because when I started working on this album, because I, you know, obviously all my creative energies have gone into raising my children in the last decade, and but they're a little older, so some time and space has opened up. And when I started working on this album, it's like I went, oh my gosh, I was so born to do this. I forgot how much fun it is to create music, and it was a huge part of myself I'd been missing for the last decade. So I feel like I'm just getting started again.
That's really awesome to hear, Lee. I'm really happy to hear that. So, everybody, the album is called Fire and Gasoline. It's out now on Big Sister Records. That's Lee Aaron's label. Go check it out. Buy it. Don't stream it. Go and buy it. It's only like it's, 10, 12 bucks in the store. Just go buy it.
It's available online at all the Amazons. Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, Amazon.uk. So, you can get it It's very available.
Lee, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you very much. And we wish you the best of luck with this album and your subsequent touring runs.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I'm excited. I can't wait to get out there and be playing these songs live and getting a chance to meet people, because that's what I do. After every show, I come out and usually hang around at the autograph table and try to meet people that come up to the show. It's my favorite, one of my favorite parts of the job.
I see a lot more artists doing that now whenever I go to shows, and that's really good, because it's good to connect with your audience, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Tony, thanks.
Okay, you too. Thank you very much, Lee.
Okay, bye-bye, Tony.